From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Former special counsel Robert Mueller is testifying before Congress today. He started this morning with the House Judiciary Committee, taking up whether the president obstructed justice in Mueller's investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. Now, President Trump claims Mueller concluded he didn't obstruct. He was exonerated. Here is Mueller's opening exchange with Democratic Chairman Gerald Nadler.
So the report did not conclude that he did not commit obstruction of justice. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And what about total exoneration? Did you actually totally exonerate the president?
No.
Now, in fact, your report expressly states that it does not exonerate the president.
It does.
And your investigation actually found, quote, multiple acts by the president that were capable of exerting undue influence over law enforcement investigations, including the Russian interference and obstruction investigations. Is that correct?
Correct.
But Republicans like Representative Ken Buck attacked Mueller's conclusions.
When it came to obstruction, you threw a bunch of stuff up against the wall to see what would stick. Well, and that is fundamentally unfair.
I would not agree to that characterization at all. What we did is provide to the Attorney General in the form of a confidential memorandum our understanding of the case. Those cases that were brought, those cases that were declined, and that one case where the president cannot be charged with a crime.
Mueller referring there, as he did several times, to an Office of Legal Counsel instruction that a sitting president cannot be indicted. Let's bring in NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Hi, Tam.
Hi.
So it feels like the two parties were having two different hearings, but start with the Democrats. Their goal was to go over the instances that the report says the president may have obstructed justice. Did they succeed?
Democrats have been very deliberate during this hearing. They are taking different parts of the report and walking Mueller through it. He's giving a lot of yes and no answers. He's not he's frequently saying, well, you just have to refer to the report. And then they immediately say, all right, let's go to that page number. And they read that part of the report. What they are trying to do is lay out a case to the American public with Mueller there sort of saying yes or no at times about various acts of potential obstruction of justice that President Trump undertook in an effort to impede the Russia investigation.
Yeah. And now we mentioned the OLC. And there was a moment, well, several, where he revealed today, Mueller, that from the very beginning of this investigation, he knew he couldn't indict a sitting president. But then there was this exchange with Representative Ted Lieu of California. After several examples of the president's possible obstruction from the report being listed.
I believe a reasonable person looking at these facts could conclude that all three elements of the crime of obstruction of justice have been met. And I'd like to ask you, the reason, again, that you did not indict Donald Trump is because of OLC opinion stating that you cannot indict a sitting president, correct?
That is correct.
Now, Tam, Mueller seemed to be saying in that moment that he would have indicted, going further than his past statements in which he said he couldn't clear the president.
Yeah, except at numerous other points during this hearing when other members of Congress said, well, that looks like the three elements of obstruction of justice. Mueller pushed back and said, that's your analysis. That's not my analysis.
Right, right.
And what he said repeatedly in this hearing is he simply could not consider whether to charge the president with obstruction of justice, never considered it because of this Office of Legal Counsel opinion that says that a sitting president can't be indicted. Mm-hmm. Now, he was also asked, what if the president is no longer president anymore? Could he be indicted then? And the answer is yes, according to the opinion.
Yeah, it seems as if Republicans' plan here was to attack the genesis of the investigation. They brought up the Steele dossier, you know, meetings with murky Russian characters to try to get at the very, you know, essence of the investigation. Was it valid? What points, if that's the appropriate word, did they score?
Well, they were, as you say, trying to bring out questions or doubts about the completeness of the report and whether it was all originated with some sort of deep state Russian measures. And they kept asking Mueller questions that he was bound by the Attorney General not to answer. Mm-hmm. And so Mueller kept saying, I can't answer that, or that is outside of my purview. And in terms of what Republicans were hoping for, that makes it look like Mueller is being dodgy. In fact, the attorney general said in a letter, no, you can't answer questions about that. It's being investigated by the inspector general, and that report is not yet out.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Tamara, back you go. Thank you.
Yes, you're welcome.
And we go from Washington to London now, where Britain's new prime minister, Boris Johnson, is forming his government. Johnson formally took office today, succeeding Theresa May as leader of the country and their Conservative Party. She spoke for the last time as prime minister in the House of Commons.
I congratulate my right honourable friend for winning the Conservative leadership election. He will take over as Prime Minister, and I look forward to a first-class Conservative government under his leadership, delivering for the whole of the United Kingdom.
And later, in his first speech as Prime Minister, Boris Johnson promised to deliver what May couldn't, Brexit.
We're going to fulfil the repeated promises of Parliament to the people and come out of the EU on October the 31st. No ifs or buts.
BBC political correspondent Rob Watson joins us now. And Rob, we heard here in the States on Morning Edition from British Conservative Party MP James Grey. Now, Boris Johnson won his leadership by just about 40,000 votes, but James Grey said there's a brand new positive energy on the street there today. Do you feel that?
It's certainly there amongst the people who like Boris Johnson within the governing Conservative Party, and I think it's probably there amongst those who voted Leave during the referendum in 2016. But Mr. Johnson's big problem is that the other half of the country that voted to remain in 2016, I mean, the vast majority of them heartily loathe him. And so in many ways, Mr. Johnson has set himself this impossible task, which is to first get Brexit done and then reunite the country. But it's very difficult to see how you would do both, because Theresa May's legacy, we were just hearing from her, is extraordinarily, one wouldn't have thought this possible, a country now more polarised even than it was at the time of the referendum. And of course, Mr. Johnson was the leader of one of those tribes, the Leave tribe.
Yeah. Well, and at one point, he and his entire family, they were Remainers. So now the person who has to make Brexit work, just remind us, Rob, what the sticking points are there, what he has to accomplish by October.
Goodness, where does one start? And one wonders, where does Mr. Johnson start? So the European Union has said, look, this needs to be a two-stage process. You need to have a withdrawal agreement, if you like, or the divorce, and then a transition, and then we can work out our future arrangements. Now, what Mr. Johnson and those who've been on the sort of the what you might call the hard Brexit, the really pro-Brexit wing of this argument has been saying is, look, you know, we don't want this idea of we're not happy about the money, paying more money to the European Union, the sort of divorce bill, and we're not happy about the kind of things that have been suggested, the sort of safeguard to avoid having to have a border in Northern Ireland and therefore possibly upset the peace process.
Well, and when you mentioned the border with Ireland, this is the border that would have to be between the Irelands, which would cut the flow between those two countries, and that's cause a lot of upset. What about the idea that he has a past, which we've been reviewing here, of somebody who didn't tell the truth all the time, when he was a columnist, for instance, but also he's highly educated, he drops Latin. I mean, which Boris Johnson do you think you're going to get?
It's a very good question. I mean, I guess I'd put it slightly a different way, and that is that there are two views of Boris Johnson. One is that he's this amazingly talented politician and communicator who occasionally lets himself down by behaviour in his private life and sort of using language a bit too unthinkingly. And then there's the other view, which is that he is fundamentally untrustworthy, untruthful, unserious and unfit for high office, but somehow gets away with it all by being so good with language. Now, I guess we're going to find out, you know, which is the true characterization of Boris Johnson in the next few weeks and months.
Yesterday, President Trump said that Boris Johnson is the British Trump. How do people there take that in?
It's not a great blessing, I wouldn't say. I mean, yes, there are some people here who admire Donald Trump, but I mean, if he thought that, he should try running for election here. It's not exactly, I don't think, what Boris Johnson would have wanted to hear for a couple of reasons. I mean, for a start, it's a reminder that Brexit will necessarily involve the UK moving away from Brussels and getting closer to Washington. And in what might be called normal times, that may be not quite so tricky, but Donald Trump is an extremely controversial character here, as he is there in the United States. I should say one other thing, which I think is slightly unfair, but a senior British politician described Boris Johnson as Donald Trump with a thesaurus. I mean, I don't think it's quite fair in the following sense, that while they're both populists and you know, very much kind of politicians, you either kind of love him or hate him. I think Boris Johnson is probably a much more sort of socially liberal character than Donald Trump.
That's BBC political correspondent Rob Watson reminding us we share the same language, but a different pronunciation of, for instance, thesaurus. Rob,
we do indeed.
Rob, thanks.
It's a good line, that, though, from Nick Clegg, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
That he was like Donald Trump with a thesaurus.
Rob, thanks as always.
All right, see ya.
A thesaurus. And by the way, a little later in the program, we will take a look at the difference between British and American English. About 1 in 10 Americans has some kind of implanted device. Artificial hips, pacemakers, I've got that titanium knee. You might think these devices are carefully regulated by the government. But according to our next guest, many are sold without any clinical testing, and less than 1% undergo 2 trials, the standard requirement for drugs. In 2015, 16,000 deaths associated with medical devices were reported to the FDA, but the General Accounting Office estimates that only 1% of device-related deaths are reported overall because there's no requirement to do so. And then there's regulatory capture, medical device executives sitting on regulatory boards, and doctors getting payments from medical device companies. And heroic patients like Dennis Fagan, we'll get to him, with investigative journalist Jeannie Lenzer. Her book is The Danger Within Us. She says that millions benefit from medical devices, but there are others, like the orthopedic surgeon being poisoned by the cobalt in his hip. We spoke to her last year, just after her book was released, and started by asking how companies are able to deflect blame for illness or death, saying the devices aren't responsible for these outcomes.
One of the problems in medicine is that when something goes wrong, doctors tend to blame the underlying condition or disease that the patient has. And when patients get better, they invariably attribute their improvement to the drug or device that they gave the patient.
And in fact, you point to lidocaine, which was supposed to reduce deadly heart rhythms, but people getting it were more likely to die.
Yes, and it was really an important illusion because these bad rhythms that are likely to kill someone, well, they disappeared. But unfortunately, so did the patients.
Right. You point to a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association that shows from 2008 to 2012, the FDA approved 400 implanted devices of moderate to high risk without any clinical testing? Do we read that right?
Exactly. In fact, the overwhelming majority of medical devices that are on the market that are implanted in patients undergo no clinical trials. So of the very high risk devices capable of causing serious injury or death, those devices, only 5% even underwent 2 clinical trials. And even those clinical trials weren't necessarily trustworthy.
How did this happen? Like, what's the overarching thing here? Yeah.
What happened was, is medical devices didn't come under the purview of FDA until 1976. And at that point, there were lots of devices already on the market, things like pacemakers, artificial hips. And so what the FDA did once devices came under their regulation was they said, okay, all you guys that are already out on the market, you can stay on the market. But we're going to divide you up into 3 classes. Class 1 devices are low risk, class 2 intermediate risk, and class 3 are the high risk implanted devices. So with the class 3 devices, companies were able to keep putting new versions on the market simply by tweaking them and saying, well, there's already a device on the market like this, so we're just going to add a supplement. Mm. Well, the original device was never put through clinical trials in the first place.
Right. Well, this brings us to Dennis Fagan, who had a VNS, or vagus nerve stimulator, implant in his neck. This was to regulate seizures. It worked for a while, and then the seizures came back even worse. It led to one horrendous night. But just briefly, what does the vagus nerve do? What did this thing do? And then what happened to him?
Well, nobody knows why stimulating the vagus nerve should control seizures. And in fact, there's really no evidence that it really does. What happened to Dennis was one night he was awakened by a pain in his throat, and he thought that that meant a seizure. He knew from prior experience that he'd have this pain in his throat with a seizure. So he got up and he put a vertical mark on his calendar on that date. And when his parents found him the next morning, there were 12 marks on that date. And they came into his house, and he stumbled out of his room and fell face first onto the floor. And then, afraid of falling again, he wiggles over, props himself up against a wall with his back to the wall. His legs are splayed in front of him. His jeans are wet with urine, and he promptly passes out again. When the paramedics come, they give him some medicine for epilepsy, and it doesn't work. So they rush him to the hospital, where the ER doctor looks at his seizures and gives him more, and it still doesn't work. And that's when his doctor notices that Fagan's heart is stopping at exactly three-minute intervals. Fagan wasn't passing out from seizures. He was passing out from lack of oxygen to the brain. The cardiologist takes a look at this, and they're all puzzled. And in comes the neurologist, who finally explains that Fagan had this VNS device put in him, and the device is set to fire at exactly three-minute intervals.
So it was the device that was meant to save him that was actually, you know, maybe it had stopped at one point the seizures, but now it was stopping his heart. And then you have this scene where everybody's running around trying to find the thing that you turn this off with. It's a magnet.
When they realize it's the device, he finally gets the doctor rushes off, gets the thing to turn it off. And when he turns it off, the seizures completely stop.
Yeah.
So it's clear that the device, instead of stopping his seizures, was stopping his heart. And despite that, the company tried to blame a medicine that Fagan was taking. But there's another way they get off the hook, and that's with the Supreme Court preemption ruling that says that you can't sue the device maker. And the rationale is, oh, the FDA has tested it so well that we can't sue them because they've been approved. Now, that's a real change. And that's part of regulatory capture, that the FDA hired somebody from the tobacco companies, the legal firm that defended tobacco companies and drug companies, Dan Troy, and he filed an amicus brief on behalf of the FDA so that people couldn't sue. And the FDA had previously always supported the right of people to sue, saying it's the only way to keep people safe so that we learn about these problems.
Well, meanwhile, Dennis Fagan tries to warn the company, the FDA. Nobody will listen to him. He finds VNS message boards on the internet where people are having this conversation. He finds databases that shows that people are dying. Meantime, we're learning some of the other problems here. Doctors have no way of even knowing if you have an implant. So when he was rushed to the hospital near death, they didn't know he had a device. I mean, that is so frightening.
Yes. It is. And unfortunately, a program to have device identifiers on all implanted devices has been in the works for over a decade, and it just hasn't happened.
He tries to get documents from the FDA using the Freedom of Information request. You say it's like a Kafka novel where he can't get the information. But where are we on medical devices? I mean, your book obviously has been explosive. But is there a sense that this might change, or is it just about educating people so that they know?
No, things are getting worse now. With the 21st Century Cures Act that was passed in 2016, they allowed the level of evidence that's used to approve devices to degrade even further. One of the problems with the device in Dennis Fagan is that that device was known to cause a high rate of deaths. And that's a direct quote from the FDA's own transcripts when they were considering the device, a high rate of deaths among the people who were implanted. They only approved the device conditionally, but they didn't require the manufacturer to tell patients that. Now, can you imagine if the company had to say to patients they were intending to implant this device in, gee, you know, the FDA has approved this only conditionally, meaning they can pull it off the market if we don't prove it's safe because a lot of people died. Would you still like to have this device implanted in you? Patients weren't told that.
Right.
And what I want to see is honesty in this reporting. It's not that I think all devices are bad. In fact, I'm the beneficiary of an implanted device. What's troubling is we can't tell the difference between good devices and deadly devices. Even people like the doctor you mentioned who had a hip implant, who was an orthopedic surgeon, couldn't tell a good device from a bad device because there isn't testing. The FDA simply isn't requiring that testing.
Yeah. Well, you suggest, first of all, a wall between device companies and physicians who use the devices and a single-payer insurance system.
Well, first of all, the no payments to individual doctors. There are doctors who've made tens of thousands of dollars, some upwards of $500,000 from device companies for implanting these devices. Now, it's hidden under phrases like consulting fees or teaching fees. That's like a judge taking money from a defense attorney.
Well, what about the single-payer system? How would that change things?
Well, right now, doctors who implant devices in particular are often paid on fee-for-service, which means that every time they implant something, they make more money. Mm. So if doctors are salaried, it takes away that incentive to do more for doing more. Hmm. And we don't have independent research. That's the other arm of my discussion, is that medical research has been so corrupted by allowing each manufacturer to do all the research and to tell us which device is the safest. I mean, that's rather like allowing Toyota to tell us which is the best car on the road. The FDA has been bought by these companies.
Well, so meanwhile, how is Dennis Fagan? He drove everyone crazy with his family, 15 emails a day, trying to get across what was happening. One of the wires that's supposed to be hooked up to the nerve from his VNS device
right.
has moved into his jugular vein, you know, a dangerous situation. How is he?
He's having a difficult time, but he's also persisting in his very lonely work of trying to get this device off the market or to get somebody to pay attention to the harm so that at least patients are warned about these possibilities.
Jeannie Lenzer, we spoke last year. Her book, The Danger Within Us, describes the largely unregulated world of medical devices. If this resonates with you, let us know at hereandnow.org.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat. Ever wish feeling too hot or too cold were optional? As summer heats up outside, just press for a thermal wave designed to provide cooling relief. Over air-conditioned inside? Leave that sweater in the car and rely on Emberwave instead. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, control your comfort.
And some more sound now from former special counsel Robert Mueller's first testimony on Capitol Hill since the release of his redacted report in which Mueller found contacts between the Trump campaign and Russians trying to interfere in the 2016 election, but no criminal conspiracy, and also said he couldn't clear the president of obstruction and couldn't indict him. This morning, he spoke before the House Judiciary Committee. Here's Zoe Lofgren, the Democrat from California.
Did your investigation find that the Russian government perceived it would benefit from one of the candidates winning?
Yes.
And which candidate would that be?
Well, it would be Trump.
Correct.
The president.
Now, the Trump campaign wasn't exactly reluctant to take Russian help. You wrote it expected it would benefit electorally from information stolen and released through Russian efforts. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
Now, was the investigation's determination, what was the investigation's determination regarding the frequency with which the Trump campaign made contact with the Russian government?
Well, I would have to refer you to the report on that.
Well, we went through and we counted 126 contacts between Russians or their agents and Trump campaign officials or their associates. So would that sound about right?
I can't say. I understand the statistic, and I believe it. You know, I understand the statistic.
Republicans asked about Mueller's decision to leave the question of obstruction of justice up in the air. Here's Texas Republican John Ratcliffe.
Can you give me an example other than Donald Trump where the Justice Department determined that an investigated person was not exonerated because their innocence was not conclusively determined?
I cannot, but this is a unique
situation. Okay, well, you can't. Time is short. I've got 5 minutes. Let's just leave it at you can't find it because I'll tell you why. It doesn't exist. The special counsel's job, nowhere does it say that you were to conclusively determine Donald Trump's innocence or that the special counsel report should determine whether or not to exonerate him. It's not in any of the documents. It's not in your appointment order. It's not in the special counsel regulations. It's not in the OLC opinions. It's not in the justice manual. And it's not in the principles of federal prosecution. Nowhere do those words appear together because respectfully, Director, it was not the special counsel's job to conclusively determine Donald Trump's innocence or to exonerate him. Because the bedrock principle of our justice system is a presumption of innocence. It exists for everyone. Everyone is entitled to it, including sitting presidents. And because there is a presumption of innocence, prosecutors never, ever need to conclusively determine it.
And Mueller pushed back against criticism from Republican Congressman Ken Buck of Colorado.
You threw a bunch of stuff up against the wall to see what would stick. Well, and that is fundamentally unfair.
I would not agree to that characterization at all. What we did is provide to the Attorney General in the form of a confidential memorandum our understanding of the case. Those cases that were brought, those cases were declined. And that one case where the president cannot be charged with a crime.
Okay, but the... Could you charge the president with a crime after he left office?
Yes.
You believe that he committed, you could charge the president of the United States with obstruction of justice after he left office?
Yes.
And we'll have more coverage throughout the day, here and now. Longtime listeners know how much we love to talk about language and the many ways it can trip us up. And today, a particular language divide. They say tannoy for public address systems, biros for ballpoint pens. We say mom, apartment, elevator. They say mum, flat, lift. They end words like theater with R-E. Why? It's not theatra. They put U's in everything. People, does color need a U? They are the English. We are Americans. The twain do not meet, as linguist and language blogger Lynn Murphy lays out in her scholarly book, The Prodigal Tongue, The Love-Hate Relationship Between American and British English. It's a topic she knows well. Lynn was born in the U.S., married a Brit, now teaches linguistics at the University of Sussex. We spoke with Lynn Murphy about her book last year. And, you know, I was displaying kind of mock indignation at the differences in the language. I actually never think about British English, but you say the Brits are apoplectic about American words invading their language. Prince Charles has railed against it. It kind of set the scene for us. How are people in Britain talking about American English?
Well, you know, it is certain British people, but there's a general fear of American English coming and taking over from British English. And so when new American words appear, when British people order things in coffee shops saying, can I get a latte or something like that, people get upset because it sounds like they're not as British anymore.
Well, let's explain that, can I get a latte? You talk about tone and the fact that the British say please and thank you all the time. You set up a scene in a bus where a bus driver opens the door, pulls up and says, thank you. The person getting on says, thank you. The bus driver says, thank you for your ticket. They give a ticket and they say, thank you, four times. And when you order something, if you don't say please, how does that hit the British ear?
It sounds like you're bossing them around. And what's kind of funny is that Americans tend to have the opposite reaction, that if you say please, it sounds more urgent. And so it might be a bit more like being bossy, you know, saying do it now. So Americans say please half as much as British people do.
Well, back to the fear of American English invading British English. What are some of the words that have maybe recently come across?
British people worry about the word cookie has come over, the word French fries or just fries has come over. A lot of things to do with eating and food, because American food has become very trendy lately. But people worry about those words replacing good old British words. So, you know, that they'll now say cookie instead of biscuit. That's not always what happens. Often the new words carve out their own little place in the British ecosystem.
Or the words that Brits think are Americanisms are not.
Yeah, often that's the case. So something like sidewalk, which the British usually say pavement, closet, where the British would say cupboard or wardrobe. Those things came over to America with the settlers, and then they were forgotten back in Britain. And now when they're heard in Britain, people think, oh, it's those American words coming over. But really, it's just, you know, the old words coming home.
Boomeranging. Bumbershoot for umbrella
is not a British word. But it gets represented as a British word in a lot of American representations of Britishness. So in the film Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, they're saying the word bumbershoot as if it's a British word, but it's not. It was Yale College slang in the 1920s, 30s, and somehow people started assuming it was an English word because it was unfamiliar and it had to do with rain.
Well, and because it's kind of cute. And,
yes.
And Americans, you point out, tend to think, oh, those Brits, you know, they say things like lovely jubbly and mad as a box of frogs. But you point out Americans say lickety split and discombobulate and hootenanny. I mean, we have our own.
We've all got fun words. But among Americans, there tends to be this feeling like British words are a bit puzzling and silly. Whereas in Britain, the stereotypes of American words tend to be more that they are redundant or a bit incorrect.
Well, this goes all the way back to the fact that we fought a war and we separated from the motherland. Noah Webster, who wrote that Britain's linguistic preferences were not to be emulated because the taste of her writers is already corrupted, her language is on the decline. And he was part of a move to discourage the new Americans from adopting certain kinds of British English.
Yeah, so he didn't want us to keep on trying to sound like aristocrats, you know. So in Britain, it's always been the language of the upper classes that's been emulated. And in America, we were supposedly getting rid of that sort of aristocratic class. And therefore, we needed a new way to speak that wasn't sort of bowing down to that part of society. He also felt like we needed to be united, and so we should try to get rid of the differences that we had because people came from different parts of England or were developing different ways of speaking in different parts of the country. So he also was looking to standardize what Americans did.
What were some of the words that he instructed people not to say?
He was very concerned with the spelling system. So he was trying to get us to use spellings like color without the U, or theater with an E-R rather than an R-E. But he went even further than that. He wanted us to spell is as I-Z and tongue as T-U-N-G. So a lot of the changes that he wanted to make happen, he didn't make happen. But still in England at that point, people were arguing whether color should have a U or not. And so Americans went one way and Britain went the other.
I'm sorry, but that's the one that just bothers me the most. But again, the Brits hold on to it because, as you explain, you speak the way the people around you speak and you want to hold on to the ways that you have spoken.
Yeah, your language is a link to the generation before you and the generation before that.
And yet, you'd think that there'd be even more erasing of the differences because everyone's on the internet.
You'd think so. But part of what's happening is that people are trying to put out their own identity. And so if you're spelling on the internet, the way that you can show what country you're from is to spell a certain way. We've seen in the last sort of 30 years an increase in British people spelling words like realize with an S instead of a Z. That was always something you could do in British English, but it wasn't something you had to do. And now that they're interacting with Americans more and more British people are seeing the S as something they have to do in order to show their Britishness.
Here's some more of the differences. Americans speak of Kleenex, Band-Aids, Styrofoam. The British generally call them tissues, plasters for Band-Aids, polystyrene for Styrofoam. Britons play sport, not sports. They pay tax, not taxes. They get toothache, not toothaches. We actually have a difference on the way we say math. Brits say maths. With an S, not
yes.
Math. What's that like for you as an American? You've been living there a while, married to an Englishman. You have a child. Are you still brought up by saying something or hearing something that is unfamiliar?
Well, I hear things that are unfamiliar all the time. You know, every time I go to an administrative meeting at the university, someone will use some cliche I've not heard before. So I'm always noting things down, learning new things. But at the same time, because I do live in this culture, because I want to be understood, and because I don't want to be made fun of every time I open my mouth, I say maths. I say herbal rather than herbal. My vowels have shifted a bit. I say my T's more sharply. And that's all because of living in it.
Yeah. Well, we can't let you go without addressing schedule. Just the history of the word, why it's schedule and schedule.
Yeah, the word was originally schedule. And then for some reason, people started spelling it differently in the 18th century. And so it was spelt as we spell it now for a while before anyone knew how to pronounce it. And so people debated, should it be like this SCH in school? Or should it be like the French were pronouncing it in schedule? And Americans went one way and the British went another way.
Linguist Lynn Murphy, her blog, Separated by a Common Language, her book, The Prodigal Tongue, The Love-Hate Relationship Between American and British English. And if you want to know how heated it can get, here's just two examples she gives us on Twitter. At British Logic proclaims, people who spell color without the U don't deserve to live. You also quote Homer Simpson as saying, English, why would I ever want English? I'm never going to England. Just great. Lynn, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So, Lynn spoke of the British thinking that sidewalk is an American word. English comedian Michael McIntyre is in that camp. On a talk show, he said, it's because Americans are, you know, stupid.
So, things like pavement. So, they can't work with pavement, so they've changed it to sidewalk. Yeah. They needed more information. They needed to know where they were going to be walking so that they wouldn't get run over.
Ha! Mike, we have the last laugh because we have Lynn Murphy, who just explained sidewalk started in Britain. We spoke with Lynn last year. To check out her blog, go to hereandnow.org. Music from the 1962 film The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, created by renowned composer Andre Previn. When he died in February, Previn left a legacy of dozens of Hollywood scores, along with a hefty discography of jazz and classical recordings. But he also left a not-quite-finished commission slated to premiere this evening at the Tanglewood Music Festival in Massachusetts. WBUR's Andrea Shea reports on the teamwork it took to bring Previn's last composition from the page to the stage.
About 2 years ago, Tanglewood director Tony Fogg was over the moon about the prospect of premiering a new piece by the great Andre Previn. Penelope, inspired by Homer's epic Greek poem The Odyssey, featured a dream team of collaborators, and Fogg says he checked in often with Previn to get updates.
The last we talked about Penelope was in early January, when it was about the time that he, by contract, should have been delivering the completed score to us.
Fogg was surprised when the prolific Previn hesitantly asked for a couple more weeks.
The old composer of Hollywood times could turn out, you know, 20 minutes of score overnight almost. And so for Andre to say he needed another 2 weeks meant there was still a fair bit of work to be done.
Previn died weeks later, on February 28th, leaving the work unfinished. But Fogg wanted to press ahead with its scheduled performance at Tanglewood in Lenox, Massachusetts, while the composer's spirit felt so alive. Still, Fogg had questions, because this would be his first posthumous commission.
Do we just perform the piece in a fragmented form? Do we ask another composer to come and complete it, using the language that Andre developed?
Turns out they didn't have to do either. Fogg says the composer's longtime editor at G. Schirmer Music Publishers was able to decode Previn's handwritten manuscript.
David knows or knew Andre's shorthand better than anyone and could decipher, you know, things that on the page to me just look like squiggles.
David Featherolf has been making sense of Previn's scores for 22 years. When he read the Penelope manuscript, Featherolf discovered some omissions.
No pitch numbers and no bar numbers, and they were certainly not in order.
But the editor did have the words that go with the music. The libretto was written by British playwright Tom Stoppard. He and the composer have been friends since the 1970s. For years, Stoppard says Previn asked him to collaborate on a piece for his muse, soprano Renee Fleming.
It was decades in getting to the starting line because Andre would call me about once a year and say, look, would you like to do something like a monodrama for Renee to sing? And I kept saying, I don't really know how to do that.
A few years ago, Stoppard relented.
In the end, Andre persuaded me to think of it as a long speech in a play and let him worry about how to make it singable.
Stoppard's words became something of a roadmap for Featheroff. Rather than call the work unfinished, Featheroff prefers not fully realized, because the music was there, it just needed honing. From the page, Featheroff heard the composer's voice.
Well, it's very Andre. Given the story, it ranges incredibly from mood to mood.
This week, Featheroff, Stoppard, and soprano Renee Fleming experienced Penelope for the first time at rehearsal. The Emerson String Quartet accompanies Fleming as she portrays Odysseus's wife, who stayed behind fending off suitors while he was away at war.
Our firstborn, Telemachus, was at the breast when the gods could no longer hold back their spot.
The crux of the story is that she was faithful to him and wise and also courageous and clever.
Fleming says Stoppard's libretto for Penelope was long. When Previn was still alive, she suggested they split the text. Now, when Penelope sings, the audience will hear Fleming. When she speaks, actor Uma Thurman will be on stage.
It was war! My godlike husband took my face between his workman's hands and spoke these words for my comfort.
Fleming thinks Previn would be pleased with his final work.
It would have been, of course, much better had he been able to control the final result, but barring that, this is the next best thing.
The Tanglewood premiere was to be Previn's 90th birthday gift. Tom Stoppard says the fact that the team was able to shape the piece and perform it as planned is bittersweet.
It's a birthday celebration without the birthday boy.
But his friends believe Andre Previn's spirit will be present and say he'll be missed. For Here and Now, I'm Andrea Shea.
You see him more than a hundred men from Ithaca and round about.
And of course, we're following Robert Mueller's testimony before members of Congress. We'll have updates and reaction throughout the day and this afternoon on All Things Considered. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.